Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg.
Hey, Fred, it's good to talk to you again.
Yep, good to see you again. Hey, I knew we were going to record today, and I wanted to hit record before you tell me about this email you sent me the other day about a newsletter you received.
Yeah, it's from the ASQ, Reliability and Risk Division, which I believe may have been something, a group that merged with what was Accelerated Reliability Stress Testing, and I think it was ASTR.
I don't know about that. I think ASTR has always been an IEEE thing. ASQ's Reliability Division added the term risk a few years ago to their title, but they didn't merge with anybody to do that.
Okay. I don't really know what happened to my old, our old Accelerated Reliability and Stress Testing, or Stress Testing and Reliability group. It kind of disappeared after, you know, I guess 20 years. I don't know how long we were organized.
That's a good point. I haven't seen much about that lately, but I digress. I wanted to follow up on, you sent me a message saying, are they, and I'll let you explain it.
Well, I'll have to ask you, a Certified Reliability Engineering, is that an ASQ subdivision?
No, it's not a subdivision. It's a, to be facetious, it's a money-making venture for ASQ. they offer, the Certified Quality Engineer, I think, was their first one, I believe as far back as the 70s or maybe late early 80s. I'm not sure when the start of those were. And the CRE was quickly followed. So they've been around for a long time. And while they're not like a state sort of, you know, you're not licensed by a state, you've have a body of knowledge, and then they give you there's a test. I think it's 4 hours or 5 hours. I don't remember what the timeline is anymore. And 150 questions and all kinds of stuff in the body of knowledge. And then they, if you get a quote passing score, whatever that is, and it's a pretty sophisticated setup of the way they do the testing. It's like a standardized test, and you get a score, and and if you meet the criteria to pass, then you get a certificate. And then what they do, which I think is actually good, is they say, over the next 3 years, you have to continue your professional development in order to qualify to recertify. So go to a conference, present a paper, write a book, work in the field of what this of reliability of some sort, things like that. And it's if you pay attention to your career and actually go out and learn something along the way, it's not hard to recertify. And then you can become recertified, and it's like a 3-year process.
And what's your role been in the CRE? I know you've been active for a long time.
Oh yeah, long time.
And I've never been a part of the CRE. And I think this newsletter we'll talk about reinforces the reason why I'm never going to be a part of the CRE. But go ahead, tell me about what your history with them is.
Yeah, no. Oh, geez.
You go back way long.
It's 30, 35 years ago when I was working in a factory, and I was doing a lot of quality work, and I was taking statistics classes and stuff. And a lot of what I was doing made sure I knew the math to do this in the certified quality engineering. And somebody suggested, why don't you know all this stuff, why don't you get certified? So I looked into it, and it has a broad, it's like the CRE, it has a broad body of knowledge. And there were a few things I didn't know much about, so I went and brushed up on those. And I think that's another good tenet of the certification things from any organization, is it breaks you out of being a specialist and being in just one area. You know, I had to go learn lot sampling. It wasn't something I was familiar with. So I went and learned about, looking at vendors and auditing and stuff like that, which I wasn't familiar with, but I learned enough to pass the test. And the statistics part is what trips up most people, both in the CQE and CRE, And so it's stuff like hypothesis tests and regression analysis and stuff like that. And I was doing that day in and day out. So that was easy. So I passed the CQE. And then over time, my job spent more and more time doing reliability and reliability statistics type stuff. So I said, I might as well get that too, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
go ahead.
You know, at the time it was, oh, I need some letters behind my name, you know, kind of thing. And I've since found that half people don't know what it is or what it stands for. And some employers even look at it going, well, that's not really useful. And we'll touch on that, I'm sure. But so along the history of all this, I started teaching classes with Mike Silverman.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a way to, and I, even when I was teaching the classes, it was, now here's what you need to know because it's going to be tested. And here's what you need to do to be actually useful in what you do in your work. You know, so it says, you know, use MTBF. And right away I said, no, never use MTBF or similar things like that. That's just silly. But in order to pass the test, you need to know the exponential distribution in MTBF because it's going to be all over the place on the test. But in practice, never use it. And so early on, I started noticing that, and this was 20 plus years ago, it was out of date. So to continue then, Kirk, I got involved with the reliability division and I got involved with a different, I got invited to write questions for the exam and I got invited to review questions for the exam and I got invited to one of their, it's like every 5 years, they get a couple different sets of teams together to say, well, how do we update this thing? And at that point, I threw my hands up and said, this is ridiculous because one of the things the facilitator did, who wasn't a quality or a reliability engineer, who was just a facilitator for these kinds of programs, she said, we're not going to change any more than 10% of the things. And I says, well, 50% of the things in the body of knowledge are obsolete. Oh, and then other things that they agreed to change, they said, well, we don't know how to test that, so we can't change it. I'm like, okay, is this...
We don't know how to test what?
A Weibull distribution. Okay. You know, there's a question on that. And, you know, you need to be able to understand when and why to use those tests, those things. So it's more like, it's a very difficult question to ask in a multiple choice test. And they said, we don't know how to test that. So we're not going to do it. And we're not going to change the body of knowledge. And I thought that was, you know, the tail leading the cart kind of thing or whatever it is. I was like, so there was a couple things in their structure that they didn't want to change much at any one time. And then they also didn't want to change things that would lead the industry and guide the industry as to what it means to be good at what you do. Instead it was a reflection of what we used to do and where we have the most questions already written so we can write more tests. Some more tests. And so at that point I was like, I'm done. I'm out of here. You guys are on your own. It's still, I think, has value for somebody that wants to know about a broad spread of what's, you know, like availability and maintenance practices and warranty and how that fits into a business and the range of types of tests that are available and a good chunk of reliability statistics, with the exception of some really outdated things like predictions and MTBI use and exponential assumptions and chi-squared test planning. I don't want to throw the whole thing out because of, you know, say 10 to 20% really are bad and maybe another 20, 30% really need to be improved. But the concepts and what it makes people do and focus on continuing to learn are all good. But that's where I'm at on it. That's my history.
Okay. All right. Well, just to say, this is what stimulated this conversation is that I sent you and Chris and some, you know, I just want to get another comment from somebody, but the December 2020 ASQ newsletter, at the bottom of it, this last, I guess, the December newsletter, they had a tech spot sample of CRE questions, part 12.
Yeah, they've been doing that for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and there's a list of 10 questions.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, I, of course, have come at reliability from a completely different frame of reference. And the fact that I started out as a field service engineer, I worked on and repaired systems and did calibration. I was in a calibration lab, and so I had to repair systems there. And when I get to, you know, when I finally came to finding out after learning from Greg Hobbs, Halt and Hass, and taking that approach, which fundamentally met with my experience in mm-hmm. repairing equipment and why equipment failed, mm-hmm. that I started to look at what the, quote, certified reliability engineering world was about.
Right.
And it really went back to, you know, back to kind of a basis in the old Mill Handbook 217 prediction methods, MTBF, activation energies, you know. And what I've seen in my experience and what I've always said to all those engineers out there, the best way to learn reliability is first understand unreliability and go out and look at real unreliability in the field and see what comes back and analyze it and go to a root cause. And then also at the beginning of a development, stress your product to break it, first of all, and find out what the limitations and strength is. Mm-hmm. And this, it's, you know, what is it? Einstein's quote, you can't come, the solution can't come from the same mind that, you know, the problem
they
came from.
The problem, or, yeah.
Yeah, created a problem. And this is what I have a problem with, is these engineers think that this the problems that cause unreliability, which in my view is errors. Somewhere errors were made, either overlooked margins in the design, overlooked or unknown use conditions that were going to be later applied to that product or that product to be used, or customer abuse and misuse, and or, you know,
there's a handful of others I could add to that list, but yeah. But I like the way you phrase it. Is, I mean, there is, if we create a perfect design and have a perfect supply chain and the customers understand how and when to use a particular product, we'll have very, very few failures.
It's true.
But if a batch of capacitors are damaged when they're installed and they're latent defects that get to the field, they're going to fail sooner than later.
Right. And that's not something that you can, it's not easily modeled. It's not as consistent or, you know, like a wear out of a gear or wear out of a tire.
Right.
We can make that. Those are really reasonable calculations that we can make based on you know, coefficients of friction, things like that.
And it's a lot of science goes into it. Yeah. In driving patterns. And you can even do it empirically. Just go measure a bunch of tires. You know, every time it goes into the shop, these guys are measuring it and how many miles are on the vehicle. And they go, oh, okay, here's a pattern. It's, you know.
Right. And those become part of the design rules. This is how we design the future wear out of, you know, the tires or whatever.
Or brake pads, for example.
Right. And we know it's consumable, so we know it's going to be replaced.
Right.
And we give an indicator to brake pads with a squeaky, you know, signal.
Oh, man, there's a propane truck in our neighborhood that really needs to change their brakes. It's kind of scary how bad their brakes are.
It's scary. A propane truck without brakes.
Yeah.
in California, where there's lots of hills.
That's right. They come down the hill in front of my house, and you just squeaking all the way down. And I says, how can you drive this thing? It's just not safe. But anyway, yeah.
So those are prognostic. Those are indicators of a wear out of a impending failure. And, you know, we know these things, some of these mechanisms, and certainly in electronics, there's capacitors, but electrolytic,
fans,
you know, they can last a long time.
Fans and the bearings on fans. I talked to somebody that wanted this. Somebody called me a couple of weeks ago and they said, can we buy a really cheap fan and just see if it will last long enough for our product? Yeah, you can do that. Why don't you just buy a more expensive fan and not worry about it, you know, or buy a fan that will work in your application. Oh, we don't want to spend the money. Okay. But you're going to spend a ton of money testing it. Okay. I get it. It's like, okay.
Yeah. And what is, you know, but a fan, we know the bearings, we know the, you know, there's a mechanical system. And the failure of a fan is usually mechanical bearing or that wear out.
Right.
So, but when we talk about solid state electronics with no moving parts, we're talking about things that, you know, mechanisms that in the silicon or solder, it's just the life of electronics and solid state electronics is so much longer than we ever need. And anybody can look around their house and see that with, I've got,
oh yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I have to defend the notion is that I did a lot of work in my career on solder joints, and some designer came up with a TSOP package, and it was very short, very stiff leads, and they would fail in 2 to 3 years. They would break. The solder would break. Perfectly good solder joints, metallizations formed. Everything else was great. It was just that the coefficient of the mismatch in coefficient of thermal expansion from the silicon in that plate on top to the circuit board below. They were our test vehicle. They were a way for us to test different soldering techniques and different solders because they would fail in like 1,000 or 2,000 cycles. And so they, whereas ball grid arrays, they lasted all kinds of, they lasted forever. But but every now and then somebody comes up with a component or a design or a modification to save space or save material or do something
that
you go, that's getting close. That's eating the margin on something that is normally very robust, you know. And so I know we do a lot of testing as the transistor size gets smaller and the wire size gets smaller inside circuits. They're starting to bump into those issues that for years, like all our household electronics, they just don't wear out, right? We don't have electromigration problems because we're not pushing tons of current down these little wires.
But
now the wires are getting smaller. And so they do a lot of characterization work to make sure they last a long time. That's part of reliability engineering, Kirk, right?
Oh, sure.
But when I'm buying those circuits, they're usually pretty good. But there's a lot of reliability engineering work behind that to make it good. And so, yes, we can buy ASICs today that are just fine, and even the smaller dimensions, and they're good. That doesn't mean that that practice of understanding those failure mechanisms and doing the wear out testing is not valid. That's why they are good. So I knew where you're going with that. Right. But if I'm just buying components and I'm sticking them together in my iPad, you know, kind of thing, I don't need to go run a bunch of tests again on that stuff. I don't, the more likely failure is somebody's going to drop it, you know, or drop it in a bucket of water. Or I guess they're trying to fix that. But I think that's like more to your point is most of our things fail because of accidents or mistakes or supply chain errors, which is different than making sure it'll last 20 years. It's a completely different problem.
Well, I think that's like a very small, well, that maybe there are some products. I just don't see in like a iPhone or in a smartphone or in stereos. I'm sitting in front of one that's probably 30 years old. Compact JVC that I plug into my
It's probably got through hole components.
Got through holes, and you know, it's. Yeah. I don't expect it to fail. I've got a 40-year-old radio. You know, things that are technologically obsolete now that still have life in them and could still be turned on. It's just like the old CRT televisions. They don't receive any signal because we've changed the broadcasting method from analog to digital, and you can't receive anything. So so many things are technologically obsolete before the wear out mode, the inherent intrinsic wear out mode of components ever becomes a problem. But we do have a manufacturing process, and I've seen so many things go wrong or overlooked, like a reflow machine not correctly adjusted, especially when we went from lead solder to lead-free solder. And it's still, you know, some industries are still changing. And that was a big effort at Dell when we did a halt and hass, was to see if solder from going from lead to lead-free was going to create new failure modes or have a problem. And they right. are, lead-free are more brittle, and but actually they may be even longer lasting than the lead, even though you you didn't need the life you had in the lead anyway.
No, not for most products.
Right.
But today's product,
but the overturning, the rate is getting higher.
Oh, I know. But the base point here is that we do those activities, whether it's, you know, discovering the failure mechanisms, the HALT approach, right? And then other ones we say, well, we know that this is a solder fatigue issue, so let's go do accelerated life tests.
Right.
And so we do the appropriate stuff.
You focus, right. You focus it on the stresses for that particular mechanism, mm-hmm. the solder. And it'd probably be rapid thermal cycling and some vibration.
So one of the questions that is on that list that you brought up earlier was probably on parts count prediction, which I know is
deal? Wait, you keep referring to parts count, but there are very, very much more in 217 than parts count. And in fact, there is very much focused on the ICES and Arrhenius equation. Okay.
Oh, and They modify everything by temperature.
Right, right. So they have these factors, quality factors, everything like this. All I consider a bunch of, you know, just silliness, because unless you know you can't really know the activation, and you've got several different activation energies, and one of them is positive, like hot carrier injection.
Yeah,
that's actually a positive. So the hotter it is, the less it's a problem.
Yeah. Well, there's some things in there. I mean, the history of those parts count predictions, and when I was at Hewlett Packard,
parts count, just say 217, because there's more than just parts and counting the part numbers.
Well, it's a euphemism for the larger system. It's a euphemism for the larger process, and there's all kinds of versions of it. The one we had at Hewlett Packard was based on the test and measurement products, which are expensive units, and every one of those units for decades were brought back, and HP engineers and technicians repaired it, root caused it, and collected all that data. And we had internally, for our products and our customers, we knew which vendors had better parts than others, and that spawned an ability to say, well, if we tally up, you know, here's all the failure rates, and they were using AFR primarily, which is the inverse of MTTF, for a year timeframes, and it was actually very accurate. But it was a very select, very guarded process to get that stuff. But as HP and other companies moved into more and more consumer goods, that discipline of doing root cause analysis went away. We just threw away the board and replaced it, and you never really knew why the board failed. It was expedient just to get the customer up with a new product,
right,
and off and running. So then that database deteriorated as the industry improved the technologies of all these components, and it became less and less useful. So then it was abandoned. But
well, and you just pointed out, as technology, especially the density of electronics and the complexity of electronics increase, those methods
aren't valid anymore. Yeah, it's a different technology. So,
that's why 217 is silly when it was still being used in the 1990s. It was using a 20-year-old database.
Well, the last time it was updated was, and it's probably 25 years ago?
Yeah, and they're still being used. People are still using 217.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
I agree. It's unbelievable, but it's part of the CRE thing is that it's still part of the body of knowledge, and it's a technique that if you Google, you know, you look for how do I do a reliability prediction, there's consultants that will do it for you. There's Telcordia and 217.
Sure, it's easy.
It's built in the software. You can you drop your BOM in there and it fills it out for you, and you get a number. It's pure fiction. It's absolutely pure fiction, but you get a number, and your boss goes, oh, that number's good. Okay.
Right. And then they later, the program fails miserably in the field, has terrible reliability. They come to you and say, hey, you said it would be, you know, 98% reliable.
They don't even say that. It'll say we're going to have a 50,000 hour MTBF, which then the rest of the group doesn't know what it means. Right.
And so, you know, there's nobody there in my, what I feel is there. And when I wrote to you and sent you this letter, I said, there's nobody there to come and challenge this stuff. I mean, it just perpetuates. I know yep. that the military, the DOD is going to continue to follow this because it's very profitable for them, for the contractors,
yep.
for the vendors to make. And I've posted in LinkedIn something about, I guess, a helicopter, how the government pays them to keep improving the reliability of what they did not achieve in the first place of their contract.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a very big monetary motivation to keep doing things that do not improve reliability because you can get a huge profit in making a marginal product and then having the government pay you because they can't transfer the program after 4 years to some other company or they can't go buy it like off the shelf.
It's all custom parts.
So I understand the motivation for that. And I know that the commercial companies are not commercial manufacturers do not rely on this as much. And you know, that they but somewhere I'm just hoping that there's somebody, some young engineer that says, this is not why electronics fail in the field. I've been in the field. I've looked at the field failures. Well, I've looked at our test failures.
You're the old
These
engineer.
Are not the reason.
You're the old engineer. You've been saying this for years, since you were young. You've been saying this. Mm-hmm. I've been saying this.
33 is young, I guess, when I met Greg.
Yeah.
Or actually about 40s when I was in my 40s when I realized, when I went and saw what traditional reliability and then met Mike Pecht. Met the Boeing engineers that came in and showed them what we were doing.
Yep.
Had a constant dialogue with Dr. Peck, and we agreed. And he's never said you're wrong, Kirk. He didn't. When we've talked, he's never said you're just being. You know, he's mostly agreed with me. And the Standards Committee on Prediction, which are continuing to perpetuate.
Yeah. So that's Kirk. The basic problem is that between some standards, not all standards, but some standards, the body of knowledge not being updated and improved to reflect what are reasonable practices, whether it's, you know, HALT and or ALT, for example, not just do a prediction off of some ancient database, breaking away, you know, it's in textbooks where they draw the information to write questions for a body of knowledge. They continue to perpetuate the chi-squared methods and the assume exponential because it's easier.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's
distribution and all this stuff that you never know and you can't know until it's out in the.
Right. But the idea is that there's a whole industry that perpetuates it and
perpetuates waste of time, misleading. Again, the paper I refer to, and I'll put in again a link, 100 times I'll put in this link because the U.S. Army wrote it.
Yeah.
Reliability prediction, a continued reliance on a misleading approach. That says it all.
Oh, yeah,
And they're the ones that came up with 217.
Oh, yeah. But this is just as one part of what's wrong with the body of knowledge that got sparked from this set of questions. Now, we need to come back. We just do a part two. And so what do you do instead? You know, how do we break this cycle? And I think that would be something to go on because we could, like I said, when we hit record we could probably rant about this for an hour and a half, which we got to let people get out of their car. You know, it's usually a 20-minute drive. So
no, but to me, this is the most important question.
Right. So let's come back and break it up.
Reliability to forward. Right.
So look forward to our next discussion about what to do instead. How do you break out of the cycle? And it's not just predictions. It's lots of things that how do you get better at what you do?
Okay. I'll tell you. Right.
Okay. Right. So if you want to chime in on this, if you're listening to this and you're like, well, what, you know, you have ideas of what to do better or, you know, what are you talking about? let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and there's a comment form there. You can get in touch with us. Kirk and I, like the other hosts of the show, are available via our About pages on Ascendo or through LinkedIn. I believe everybody's on LinkedIn and more than welcomes interactions there. So Kirk, hang on. We're going to sign off here. We'll come back and we'll sort out a what to do about this problem.
I always love to talk to you about it, Fred.
All right. We'll talk to you soon then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.